You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Now for the latest chapter in the continuing story of the mysterious hobbit bones of Indonesia. Let me recap for you where we are now. Let's go back to the beginning. In 2003, an international team of scientists is digging on a remote island in Indonesia and unearths something mysterious. It's a tiny hominid skeleton that didn't look exactly like a human or our ancestors or anything else. Scientists who discovered the fossils claim that they represented a whole new ancient species never seen before. Well, the critics said, not so fast. They could be bones from diseased pygmies. And they're not really anything to get that excited about. They're really humans, but their pygmies would have a disease that makes their heads a little smaller. But evidence that these fossils are indeed a new species in our genus has mounted over the last few years, and the latest research published this week in the journal Nature focuses on the so-called hobbit's feet. These feet happen to be remarkably large, and many paleontologists got a chance to see the bones and the foot bones up close and personal last week. They got to see them when they were shown to the public for the first time. Did that change anybody's mind? Well, here to talk about it are my guests. William Jungers is chairman of the Department of Anatomical Science at Stony Brook University Medical Center. He is the author of one of the papers this week, and he joins us by phone from Chicago. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Daniel Lieberman is a biological anthropologist at Harvard. He is the author of another Nature article commenting on the research, and he joins us by phone from his office there. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Lieberman.
I'm delighted to be here.
Bill, tell us about these foot bones. Why are they so important?
I think the foot bones are a window into the past, even though they're only 17,000 years old. I think they give us a glimpse into what the primitive ancestral morphology of the first foot of our own genus Homo probably looked like. So in that sense, they're unexpected and they're exciting, and they also reveal a foot that really isn't modern in aspect. It's a foot of a biped, a perfectly efficient biped in terms of walking, but it lacks some of the design features that we associate with our own foot, and actually some of those features have been spelled out very nicely by Dr. Lieberman.
Dr. Lieberman, tell us about the features.
Well, I have to say it's a jaw-dropping foot. When I first saw the paper, I actually ended up writing "wow" in the margin of the PDF because I was astonished. So it's like a human foot in a bunch of ways. It's got very robust toe bones. They're called the metatarsals. They're the bones sort of in the middle of your foot before the individual toes start spreading out. And it's got a sort of an ankle joint that would have been clearly very good at the kinds of movements that a human has. Mm-hmm. And it's got a little locking mechanism in the middle of the foot. So when we pick our heel off the ground when we're walking, it keeps the middle of our foot rigid. So all that looks like what you expect to find in a biped. But what I was so astonished by was this one bone in particular that for me sold it. It's called the navicular. And it's a little bone on the top of the inside of your arch. It's like the keystone of the arch of your foot. And in humans, it's a tiny little bone, and it never touches the ground unless you're flat-footed.
Hmm.
But in this critter, just looking at the photo, you can see it has this great big, huge tuberosity, this big, large process, essentially, on the navicular, which you find in chimpanzees, and that's indicative of that this bone was actually in contact with the ground. And that means that it didn't have the kind of arch that you and I had. So
that's the flat-footed part, yeah.
Yeah, so it still could have walked, but it probably wouldn't have been so good at running. And it's got it's like our feet in some ways, but it's unlike our feet in other ways. And as Bill Jungers mentioned, it's like a window into the past because we don't have any really good feet from early on. So this is actually our best view of what an early hominid foot looks like before they became completely modern.
So was this the clincher for you about this being a new species?
I wouldn't say it was the clincher, but it was one of a whole series of pieces of evidence that I was waiting for and looking for to seal the deal for me. So this is one of them, the wrist, which was published last year in another paper. And another paper that really kind of, for me, was very influential was two other papers. Was the one on scaling in hippos, which is also in this issue of Nature, and also a very nice paper by Babb and McNulty, which is on in the new version of a new edition of Journal of Human Evolution, which is a very careful scaling analysis and asks the question, if you took a Homo erectus skull and you, or a Homo habilis skull, and you scaled it down, you corrected for, you know, you made it smaller, but you observed all the relationships between size and shape, what would be the shape of that skull? And they find that, that this Floresiensis skull falls right where it should be. It looks like a very dwarfed, very small Homo erectus or Homo habilis. And you add all those bits of evidence together, then you have to start paying serious attention to the hypothesis that this is a real species and not a not a dwarf.
I can't let your comment about the hippo paper being the hippopotamus paper being related to this. Tell us how that was one of the pieces of the puzzle.
Well, I think the most serious critique of the material has been that generally, when you make a species smaller, the brain doesn't get that much smaller. So if you compare a human being, such as most of the listeners to your program, with, say, a pygmy, somebody who's a bit smaller in body size, the body size gets can get considerably reduced, but brain size doesn't really change very much at all. The slope of that line is very flat. So generally, when species get shrunk down in size, their brains don't get much smaller. And so a colleague at the university at Chicago had argued that if you obey the scaling relationships that we typically know of in the world, you would have to make a Homo erectus, I think, 6 kilos in mass and body mass in order to get the brain size of Floresiensis, which is of course impossible. So that was a serious critique. But what one of the things that this hippo paper shows, and also some of the other papers that are in Jungers and others have also published, is that, A, the body size in this creature was already pretty small in the first place. Mm-hmm. So correct me, Bill, but I think the body mass of this skeleton is about 30 kilos.
Very close to that, yeah, with a little range around it, but that's very close, yes.
And then the other thing is that they were able to show that when hippos undergo island dwarfing in Madagascar, it can actually push the brain sizes way down below the slopes that are much, much steeper than we are told could be the case. And that's because brains are really costly. You know, when you're sitting listening to me, your brain is using about 20 to 30% of the calories of your body, which is a huge amount of energy. And if you imagine you're trapped on a small little island and there's not much to eat, and you want to save energy, well, one of the ways that animals save energy is they reduce their body size. But another way to save energy is to reduce their brain size, and they can reduce their brain size far more than those scaling relationships predicted. So that means that you can, you really can dwarf down the brain of a creature and get something of the sort that you get in Floresiensis. It obeys rules of biology that we see in other creatures.
Bill,
yeah, can I just add a note to footnote to that? I think one of the most exciting things about the hippo paper is that it reinforces a study that had been completed earlier on a dwarf bovid from Majorca and other parts of the Mediterranean that show that it looks like brain size selection, that is, evolution can act on brain size independently of body size. And that's what allows us to hypothesize that, you know, this brain could be reduced beyond what one would expect based on small body size alone. That's an exciting development. It's sort of that confirms some things that we didn't. It was a rule. In other words, this island dwarfing rule has been broken apparently repeatedly, and so Floresiensis doesn't stick out that much the way it did it originally.
So what's your guess on where it originated from?
I think there are really two sort of competing hypotheses on the table, and I think I know where Dan stands on this. I think that we already know that there is a early hominin in Southeast Asia, including Indonesia, as early as 1.5 million years ago. That's called Homo erectus.
And Homo erectus actually has a fairly modern body plan. So the hypothesis, one, is that this is a dwarf descendant of Homo erectus that got on the flores and was isolated and underwent body size reduction and disproportionate brain size reduction. The problem I have with that hypothesis really is that it requires a large suite of evolutionary reversals and other parts of the skeleton that don't make a heck of a lot of mechanical sense to me. You sort of give up things that Homo erectus evolved in terms of long hind limbs and modern feet. So is it possible? Yes. I just think it's not very probable. The alternative hypothesis that I tend to favor has people scratching their heads in terms of the biogeographical implications. I've suggested that perhaps Homo parisiensis is descended not from Homo erectus, but from an early hominin that's already quite small-bodied and has a relatively small brain and a more primitive overall skeletal anatomy. And that's something like Homo habilis, known from Africa well before 2 million years. I think that neither one of those arguments, sort of discounts the other completely. Some combination is possible, but I think those are the two arguments that are now in play.
Dan, do you agree?
Well, I would add a third hypothesis, which is that Homo erectus is very variable and changed over its time period. Maybe we should split it into two species, but that the very earliest Homo erectus fossils that we find are actually much more primitive in some respects than the later ones we find. And so, for example, there's some fossils from a site in Georgia in the Caucasus that called Dimanisi, and there's some skulls and skeletons actually there between about 1.7 and 1.8 million years old. And unfortunately, we don't have any feet or wrists from those things, but they do look primitive in a number of ways. The shoulder, for example, actually Bill has published some really neat data showing that the shoulder in that creature is kind of primitive, and primitive in a way that you sort of see in Floresiensis. And there's some early African Homo erectus specimens, which might be pretty primitive. So the third hypothesis would be that, so in addition to Homo erectus being the ancestor and Homo habilis being the ancestor, it could be that early Homo erectus is the ancestor. It got somehow onto this island.
That was the question I was going to ask next. How did it somehow get there?
Well, that's a great question. It would have to have swum considerably or had a raft or something like that, because we actually know that there's actually archaeological data from that island dated to about 800,000 years ago. So somebody had gotten onto that island at least 800,000 years ago, presumably the ancestors of...
And they would know how to build a boat or
That was one of the news headlines when these were first reported in 1998, was that Homo erectus was a seafarer. That's pretty unlikely. But you do have to cross open water at least twice, no matter which hominin got there, whatever hominin is the ancestor of Homo parisiensis, had to cross relatively deep water. The island of Flores has never been connected to the west or to the north, even at the lowest sea levels when glaciers tied up all the water. So that results in a very strong filter, and that's why there's such a limited fauna on the island. You have to realize that the hominid named Homo parisiensis shared the island with pygmy proboscideans called stegodon, giant stork-like birds, big rats, and oversized giant Komodo dragons, and that's the bulk of the fauna. So you're east of a line called Wallace's Line. That's a very profound biogeographical filter. So we're not sure how they got there, but something made it there, and not many things made it.
I have to just jump in for a second and give it a station break. This is a Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow talking with William Jungers and Daniel Lieberman. I think they're getting a new movie starring Jeff Goldblum together here for the other island where these creatures were living. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you. You had another take on it, Daniel?
Well, no, this is it's a facetious hypothesis. But, Stegodon obviously swam, these elephants that got to the island. So, if Homo floresiensis or its ancestors, the Homo erectus or Homo habilis or whatever, didn't get on a raft or a tree that somehow, there had to be a male and a female, of course. Maybe they got on the back of an elephant and get to the island.
Yeah, my colleague Mike Moore, with the archaeologist in charge of this expedition, has looked at the currents, and he believes that
there's an island to the north of Flores called Sulawesi, and there are actually some fairly early archaeological sites there. We don't have any bones that go with them yet. And he argues that the last glacial maximum, when Sulawesi was in fact closer to Flores than it is now, if the prevailing currents, which go from Sulawesi to Flores, still persisted, that some kind of, you know, island hopping might have taken place. And then there's always the, you know, the tsunami lottery that drives something, you know, offshore and as far out as Flores. But again, we really are at a loss to come up with a concrete answer to that.
Well, you know what Carl Sagan was asked about, Little Green Men from Outer Space, he said, extraordinary circumstances require extraordinary evidence.
Well, you know, something got there. We know their tools were being made almost 900,000 years ago by something. And that's probably the ancestor of the hobbits. And Dan's point's well taken. We don't yet know for sure which hominid that was likely to be. But just to make a sort of a footnote to his comment, even the Homo erectus from Dmanisi already shows long hind limbs and features that we associate with endurance running, I believe. And those would have to be sacrificed as part of this evolutionary dwarfism, if that were the proper explanation. That's a hard sell for me.
Do you think you've won over many critics with this last showing of the foot bones?
You know, I hope so. I mean, there's been a very positive response. I've gotten a lot of email and telephone calls. But I have to think that there's been a lot of evidence that's already been published. But unfortunately, this is just another independent line of evidence that I think cumulatively has taken and pulled a lot of people off the fence. And I'm glad to hear that Dan is one of them, because I think that there is still a very vocal minority of people who are trying to discount this as a pathological human. But I think the evidence is overwhelmingly against that notion.
Dan, you're in that camp now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm convinced. But, you know, the job of scientists is to be skeptical. I mean, that's what we're paid to do. We're not, whenever we train our graduate students when they open a paper, particularly if it's in science or nature, to read it with a critical eye and try to think of what's wrong with it. That's how science works. Works at its best, actually. And it does still strain credulity to think about this, you know, little tiny creature with a brain size of 417 cubic centimeters, the size of a chimp, on an island 17,000 years ago, connected 1.8 million years ago to some creatures in Africa.
We're going to leave it there.
It's up to be skeptical, but on the other hand, there's a lot of data now which shows that in terms of the shape of its head, the shape of its wrist, the shape of its feet, it does look like a small little early Homo.
So we're going to have to leave it there with William Jungers and Daniel Lieberman. Stay with us. We'll come back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News.